Mary Magdalene has hardly slept or eaten in days. And so it isn't surprising to find her wandering outside early Sunday morning. The sun isn't even close to rising. It's still dark, and she's not exactly sure where she's going. Her feet finally take her to the tomb of her beloved teacher. Now, she knows very well that they had set a large stone in front of the tomb to seal it. She knows that she won't be able to see him or touch him, but she longs for a bit of his presence. She's seeking comfort, as we all do, by reaching for something, something solid, something that she can grab onto. Mary is startled to see that the stone has been rolled away. She runs to Simon and Peter and all the other disciples. "Come, come quickly." They follow her, and together they look upon the empty tomb. Wasn't it enough to have witnessed the execution of their beloved teacher? Now, grave robbers have taken away his body. The men silently return to their homes. The sun is coming up, and they are afraid for their safety. Mary, though, decides to stay, and that's when she sees the angels. That's when she sees Jesus. She runs to catch up with the others to tell them this most amazing news. This morning, it is the task of every Christian community to make meaning of this rather puzzling Easter event, the resurrection of Jesus. And it is also our task. Even though we don't call ourselves a Christian church anymore, we do claim 400 years of Protestant Christianity as our heritage. It is also our task because we value the life and ministry of Jesus of Nazareth, the story of his death and resurrection. That story is part of his life, and we can't set it aside just because we don't believe in it. Last week, I talked about religious metaphor and described Unitarian Universalism as taking the middle way when it comes to religious stories. We neither believe those stories as literal fact, as dogmatic truth, nor do we reject them outright as lies and therefore useless. Taking the middle path between the literal interpretations that some people reject and some embrace, we find many kindred spirits, many partners on that road. Progressive Christians, Catholics, Protestants from many denominations use the story of Easter as they would a boat to cross this great river to the shore of new understanding. We join them this morning in listening to the Easter story as myth and understanding it as spiritual metaphor. A myth is not a lie. In our common everyday usage, we often equate those two, myth and lie. But in fact, a myth can often be truer than the facts of everyday life. The myth of the birth, ministry, death, and resurrection of Jesus is not a lie. A myth is a collection of images and stories that present a metaphor of the possibilities of the human experience. A myth is a collection of stories and images that present a metaphor of the possibilities of the human experience. That definition comes from Joseph Campbell, one who has spent his entire life thinking and writing about comparative mythology. The myth of Easter presents us with a metaphor of the possibilities of the human experience. The possibility of an experience of life that is both full of joy and boundless love and is free from the mind's cravings that separate us from true life. Now, before we dive into the metaphorical meaning of Jesus' death, let's first try to understand the meaning of his life. Jesus didn't just drop into human history from nowhere. Like every person born into this world, he was a continuation of generations and generations that went before him. Here was a man born to a family of modest means. He was a Jew, a member of a minority group. He was affected by the culture and politics and religion of his time. There were legions of Roman soldiers that lived near him in Galilee. Violence and conflict were constant companions throughout his whole life. He would watch as the Greco-Roman culture chipped away at his own Israelite culture. He watched as some of his people took up arms to fight against the oppressor, and some of his people quietly acquiesced as statues of the emperors were built on the holy lands and temples were turned into commercial centers. One theologian describes how marginalized Jesus and his people were, saying, "Jesus was not protected by the normal guarantees of citizenship, that quiet sense of security that comes from knowing that you belong. If a Roman soldier pushed Jesus into a ditch, he could not appeal to Caesar. It would just be another Jew in the ditch." In this way, he was very much like all the other Jews in Palestine in those days. He was quite ordinary. And in other ways, he was quite extraordinary. Jesus had somehow woken up to the true nature of his being, to the nature of all human beings. Jesus had somehow become enlightened. Now, Christian scripture doesn't tell us when or how this spiritual awakening occurred in his life, but we know that by the time he started his ministry at the age of 30 or so, that awakening was fully present in his preaching and his encounters with other people. He was able to experience God in himself. Though he didn't interpret this experience as something that's personal and unique to him, he saw God in everyone he met. This is the fullest expression of the UU covenant to affirm the inherent worth and dignity of every person. That means to see God in every person. Jesus also believed that every human being had the capacity to know God in himself or herself. Now, for those of us for whom God, the word God, has lost much of its meaning, theologian Stephen Mitchell helps us to understand God in a broader way. "If we compare God to sunlight," he writes, "we can say that the heart is like a window. Cravings, aversions, fixed judgments, concepts, beliefs, all forms of selfishness or self-protection are, when we cling to them, like dirt on that window. When there is no dirt, the window of the heart is perfectly transparent, and the sunlight can stream through it without hindrance." That's what it was like to be with Jesus, like sitting next to a clear, clean window through which pure light shone through. In other words, people who were near Jesus felt love pouring into them. They felt seen. For the first time, maybe, in their whole lives, they felt seen for the person they really are. They felt fully forgiven for everything they had ever done or said. And they felt loved without condition without reservation. His followers and disciples could see God in him, but they could not yet see God in themselves. Jesus could see that those around him had no or very, very little consciousness of the presence of the universal spirit within themselves. And this, he knew, was a source of great suffering for all people. This inability to see the divine in yourself. In his Maundy Thursday sermon, Preston told us that life for Jesus was inherently a communal experience. Accordingly, his ministry was not a personal self-improvement program, but rather a communal process of spiritual awakening. Stephen Mitchell describes the dynamic this way. Jesus was a man who emptied himself of all doctrine and desires, all that mental claptrap and spiritual baggage that separates us from true life. He has been filled with the vivid reality of the unnameable. Because he has let go of the merely personal, he is no one and he is everyone. Because he allows God through the personal, his personality is like a magnetic field. The closer they approach, the more they can feel the purity of his heart. Big crowds came. Big crowds came whenever he spoke, not only to hear his words, but to be just in his presence, just to feel that purity of heart. As Preston mentioned in the children's story, to the people who held political and economic power, to those who needed to keep control over the social order, Jesus was a huge problem. Their social order depended on people knowing their place and staying where they belonged. And yet, Jesus kept crossing boundaries, keeping company with the wrong types of people. They had to do away with Jesus. So on Thursday, Jesus draws those closest to him around the table. One last time, he's going to try to explain and try to get them to see that he is not some kind of magician. He wants them to realize that every person is a child of God, that every person is endowed with this divine light. The same spirit that enlivens him lives in them, and it doesn't depend on his spiritual presence, his physical presence, his actual bodily presence. And the disciples are straining to understand. It's hard for them to grasp this concept when Jesus says to them, "The kingdom of heaven is within you. The kingdom is within you." To them, it's still all about Jesus. And yet the whole point of his ministry was to make himself, as a personal ingredient in this process, irrelevant. From the beginning, his ministry pointed toward the day when he would no longer be with them. When Jesus dies on Friday, his followers feel like the magic has died. On Sunday, they see the empty tomb and yet are so overcome with their own fear that they do not sense the presence of Jesus in their midst. Everybody except for Mary. The men have gone back to their homes. Mary Magdalene remains, and she peers into the tomb. Her eyes adjusting to the darkness, she thinks she sees something. She hears something. She senses a presence. Somebody is with her. Now you who have lost your beloved, you know what it's like to wish for that person's presence so much that you can almost feel him or her. There is a sense of real connection. Mary wants to just reach out and find him there. But she hears him saying, "No, no, don't touch me. Don't cling to me." I think Mary understood what this meant, if not right there in that moment, then soon after. There's always this temptation to use religion as a comfortable shelter from sorrow rather than a stimulus to really change the heart, to wipe off that dust and dirt from the window. That's how Jesus becomes an object of devotion, an object of worship, rather than the subject of our faith. So I think Mary understood this. I think she felt his strong presence. She felt that same radiance and light, even though he was gone. And after all this time believing that he was the source of that light, I think she finally experienced that divine light within herself. And eventually, the others began to feel that same radiance as they stopped clinging to him. And now, after all that has happened, the followers of Jesus are finally able to hear his words, finally able to hear what they had not been able to hear while he was still alive. The kingdom is within you. And wherever two or more of you are gathered in my name, I am there. They can feel this because even though he's not physically present, he is actually dead and gone. The wonderful sense of spiritual presence they felt while he was with them is persisting. Together, as a community, they find their own sources of light by clearing away the delusion, selfishness, fear, by letting the sunlight flow through a clean window. Writers have described the early communities of Jesus' followers as places of joy unspeakable and full of glory. And this is the good news of Easter, that every person can experience a new life if she deeply desires it. Every person can share in this spiritual value, no matter what his family background or social or economic class or even religious temperament. Having the experience of sunlight pouring through the clear glass of your heart is not limited to people who believe in God. It is a universal experience, a capacity that allows one to have an experience of their life that is both full of joy and boundless love and is also free from the mind's cravings that separate us from true life. And so, on this Easter morning, we sing Alleluia, for we are offered these gifts of new life over and over again, day after day. So may today be yet another celebration of love, awakening, and a feast for the Spirit. May it be so.